Hello, hello, and welcome back for yet another episode of the IBS Freedom Podcast, episode 130-something, people. We are rocking and rolling with season two, and in today's episode, we're going to be talking about the question, why are food allergies and food reactions and celiac disease on the rise? And before any of you negative Nancy naysayer people say they're not on the rise, people are just losing their mind. No, they're really on the rise. We're going to talk about some of the data on this. That, you know, I think that it's a bit of a mixed bag, but we have pretty good quality evidence that food allergies and celiac disease are definitely on the rise. We could maybe extrapolate and talk about whether or not food sensitivities are on the rise as well, but we're probably going to be talking mostly about those two, like, more clear-cut diagnosable conditions. I think that this is really apropos too, because Amy, you have a baby, and she's, what, 9 months old?
She'll be 10 months in 4 days.
Yeah, close enough. We're going to, this episode posts, she's going to be like 10 and a half months old. So we're going to give it to her now. Mm. So, you know, to get right into this, one thing that seems to influence the rate of food allergies, at least, and potentially celiac disease, is when you choose to introduce allergenic food. So do you want to just start off by sharing what some of your strategy has been, or if there's really been any strategy at all to this?
Yeah, I mean, it can be kind of intimidating at first when you're a parent figuring out what foods to introduce. I mean, I feel like the first 4 or 5 months or whatever, and they're just feeding from the boob, or whether they're getting formula or breast milk or whatever, it's much easier because it's just one thing. And then, I don't know, I hadn't really strategized until it sort of snuck up on me. Like, what do I do? Is there a method that I need to do when I introduce allergens? And basically, I talked to her pediatrician, and her pediatrician had a bit of a relaxed approach, just basically saying, introduce allergens, introduce allergens one by one. So you probably don't want to be introducing peanuts, dairy, gluten, like on the same day, or wheat, I should say, on the same day. You want to space them out. So that was the biggest thing we did. We were pretty relaxed about it. So usually,
so you wouldn't intro like pizza, for example, because that would have several allergens in it.
Correct. So basically what we did was I didn't really have a method as to which allergen I was going to do first or not. So I'm trying to think. I think we might have introduced wheat first, if I remember. So she had maybe a little bit of like sourdough or something. Like, she had some wheat first. And wheat was the only thing in the bread. It was like a vegan type bread, sourdough bread that she had. Mm-hmm. So we introduced wheat first. And then I think we did a little peanut butter. And then I think we did yogurt, like we did some dairy. Then we did egg. And then we introduced some of the like tree nuts. Those have been a little bit more gradual just over time. Pretty much we're relaxed now. Like, she hasn't really shown any signs of allergy. The only thing that was a little bit weird is she had a few isolated hives for a while, and I was not sure. They weren't to the extent where I was hyper worried. I thought it was more so maybe a reaction to some of the detergent or something, rubbing. Because where it was typically was on her belly or on her back, and she spent, at the time where these were more prevalent, she was on her belly all the time and on her back all the time. So to me, it might have been more of like an abrasive type reaction. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting, because I know in dietetic school, the tides were shifting around that time, was when there was a big push to intro the peanut butter and the peanuts way earlier. To me, again, it felt like the tides were shifting around that time. So I'm trying to think when I was in school, like maybe 2016 or something, 2015 was when the research was kind of really starting to pick up that delaying the introduction of allergens was probably not a great idea, and has been increasing peanut allergies in particular, that was a big thing that was covered in my dietetic school. Like, I remember that pretty vividly, and I don't remember much. I remember a lot, but like, again, there's
she's blocking out the painful memories.
Right. But I do remember that being a big topic of conversation in a few classes. There must have been a study or something that came out around that time that I could probably find. Yeah. But it is kind of crazy because when I grew up, there was, I would say, virtually no peanut allergies in my grade school class, you know, whereas today I feel like there's an isolated table for peanut allergy people. And I think newer research is sort of showing that removal of that from the diet could have created more of the allergies. And it might not have been the full picture of just the removal causing more of the allergies. It's a factor, I think.
Yeah, it's nudging these kids closer to the potential for an allergy, I think is the best way to put it.
Right.
Especially too, because, and I know that this was not at all your intent, but I want to verbalize it anyway. We're in no way blaming the parents.
Yep,
right. So if you had your kids 10 years ago and you were just doing what your pediatrician told you at the time and you delayed the introduction of these allergens, like you were just doing the best you could with the tools and the advice and the knowledge you had at the time.
Yeah. And probably probably my profession was telling you to delay. Probably the RD world was telling people to delay introductions. That's why it was such a big deal.
And the internet.
Right.
Parenting books. I'm sure that this was not even just isolated to one profession.
Right.
I don't remember the dates. And before we recorded this episode, I was kind of quickly scrambling to find some dates to share with you guys. But I agree. My memory is I don't remember any food allergies in my school growing up.
Right.
Or maybe there would have been like one kid in the whole school or something. And then I met my first celiac friend my freshman year of college. So that would have been 2004. And that was super foreign to me. Like, what? You can't have bread?
Well, and you weren't even celiac at that time, right? Right? You weren't diagnosed.
I had no idea. Now, the question is, like, had it begun by that point or not?
Right.
Is a question. But I kind of don't think that it had. I think that that probably started a little while later. But yeah, like, it was such a foreign idea to me at the time. And my heart really went out to her because this seemed like such a huge life-altering thing. And I think in part because I had never heard of such a thing before, or I really hadn't met anybody with that struggle before.
And there was gluten-free products, really. I mean, what year was this? Like
2004.
2004. Like there's nothing. There's
nothing.
And if there was, it was disgusting.
Yes, it was like cardboard.
Right.
I remember she sustained herself primarily on artichokes and cucumbers for whatever reason. And she like ran marathons and rode with me and was very active. And I just remember her eating produce and nothing but produce, but especially those two things. And there was this one little hole in the wall, like the size of this room, right? Little teeny tiny like vegan hippy dippy store, and it was the only place in hundreds of miles that carried any sort of gluten-free product. So I think every now and then she would get the crappy gluten-free bread from that one little store, and they would have, you know, like tofu and veggie dogs and stuff for me because I was a vegetarian still at the time. But yeah, it's like it went from being a relative non-issue or a very uncommon issue to I could rattle off 10 friends who have kids with food allergies now, and some of them are quite severe. So it's really wild how it picked up. I think if I could derail the allergy conversation for one quick second, and then we'll come back to it. I think the easiest way to conceptualize this topic of why are food allergies and celiac disease and potentially food sensitivities on the rise, I think there's really just two answers to simplify it. I think the food is different and our bodies are different.
Right.
I mean, you could also throw in our relationship with our food is different too. you know, more and more people doing diets and like really restrictive diets and a lot more food fear and disordered eating. I think that that's probably a piece of it too. And like the choice of when to introduce allergens, that's more of like a food relationship sort of thing. But if you think about, we have staggering rates of, you know, sedentary lifestyles, obesity, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, diabetes, autoimmune disease, cancer. We have all of these health problems that are also increasing in incidence. And our diets have never been this unhealthy and this devoid of nutrition. Our relationship with food has never been worse. We are exposed to God knows how many chemicals and like pesticides and herbicides and bisphenol A and phthalates and parabens and metals and pollution and mold. Like God knows what we're exposed to every day, right? And it's just, it's so much for our bodies to cope with that, that something's got to give. If you transplanted your existing body back into like the 1920s, where there just wasn't the same amount of chemical exposure and there wasn't the same type of stress in your life and like the world was different, I think that probably a lot of allergies and celiac disease might even be cured by just transporting you 100 years back in time, because it would take that stress off the body. And then there's the whole conversation about what we're doing to the food and hybridizing and GMOs and dousing with pesticides and, you know, selecting wheat that has more gluten and that whole conversation, which I'm not an expert in.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in it either. But I do think from a broader bird's eye view standpoint, it would be really interesting. And I don't know if there's a study like this, but I know we've talked about it before where, you know, when a client goes to Europe and they can eat everything and they don't have celiac, but they have maybe a gluten sensitivity and they respond differently to the food in Europe compared to the food here. And sometimes people boil it down to, and it could be largely this thing where their wheat is different. It's like not as hybridized. And so it's better tolerated. Kind of like what you were describing. The food system has kind of changed how the wheat is structured. But I also just think they don't have in Europe as like a big conglomerate food system where you have Kroger or whatever, these big superstores. I don't even know any other grocery stores. Why am I drawing a blank? But like you go to a huge grocery store, whereas if you are in Italy or whatever, you know, you have villages that have maybe a baker, and maybe they have more of this like centralized sort of food system where, you know, you have bigger grocery store chains. But I don't think you see that very much in Europe. Usually it's like more localized networks.
Yeah, like of, mom and pop shop.
Right.
Sort of stuff. Yeah.
Right.
That'd be interesting, actually, because I've never traveled to Europe. So I wonder if some of our viewers will comment on this video and share what their experience was like going to Europe. A, from the standpoint of, you know, what was the grocery shopping experience like? Was it really more mom and pop shops and farmers markets and getting things from the farmers? Or do they have their equivalent of like a Kroger or an Albertsons or a Wegmans or whatever? If you're sensitive to wheat here, could you eat the wheat there?
Right. But I also just think even the size of the countries are smaller. Like even if it is just a countrywide supermarket chain or something, to me, it's usually going to be a lot less all over the map, like our supermarket chains are, where we're importing stuff from all these different countries. I don't think that that's happening in other countries as much as it's happening here.
I don't know. Again, I've never been to Europe, so I couldn't say, but I'll be curious to see what people comment in the YouTube comments on this video.
Right. Right.
Because again, this is just something I haven't experienced. But I've heard many, 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 many patients.
Yeah,
who,
me too.
Again, I think this has all come from people who are non-celiacs.
Right.
But virtually everybody I've ever talked to who is sensitive to gluten here in the States and they've gone to Europe for whatever reason, virtually 100% of them have said, oh yeah, I was able to eat wheat like as much as I want. whenever, you know, wherever, whatever, give me a donut, give me a piece of whatever in Europe. But if you think too, Europe, most of it, my understanding is that they have a much different culture around food.
Yeah.
I've heard people say that either it drives Americans crazy because the Europeans eat so slow, or like the Europeans kind of judge the Americans because we're just shoveling the food in our right. face and running out the door. So it's also a different experience when you are eating with a group of people and chit-chatting and having a lovely dinner and sipping on wine. And when you take, you know, 2 hours to finish your meal versus in America, you know, what, like, come on, be honest, 10 minutes, 15 tops to scarf down your food and then right back to work, as is the American way. Like, that's just, that's totally different world.
Yeah. And I even think people just being on vacation and relaxed or whatever could make a difference. So there are different variables there, but it has happened enough, I think, cumulatively for both of us, that it is really interesting that it does seem to be, there does seem to be something happening when people go on these European vacations that, again, the week could be different. Maybe it is more experiential where they're just enjoying the experience of being on vacation, eating some really great food, and it's a longer process and it allows more for rest and digest to take shape. I don't know. Maybe, again, there's just the placebo effect of thinking European wheat is better than American wheat could increase your tolerance. Who knows?
I feel like it's probably several factors, right? Like, I think that there probably is a sliver of the pie chart where, it's a placebo effect. You heard your coworker say that they could eat the pretzels in Germany, and then you got excited and you thought, yeah, maybe this is true for me too. So I think there's probably a little bit of placebo, a bit of you're on vacation and you just feel great because you're on vacation, a bit of you're just eating slower and eating in a bit more of a European style, which is good for your rest and digest. And then I think that probably my guess, my intuition is that the biggest slice of the pie chart is still just that the wheat is different and it's not doused in pesticides and they care for their crops a lot more. I know too, you would think that I would know this because I grew up in farm country, but I don't. When we harvest grains and we put it in a silo or we put it in a big mountain, you know, like a mountain of corn or a mountain of wheat or whatever on the ground, grains can sit in silos for years potentially before they get ground up into cornmeal or flour or whatever.
Right.
So that's a whole other issue too with grains, is that a lot of them can become moldy or not be as nutritious because we mass produce it so much that we let it sit and potentially go bad or get moldy for a really long time before we consume it, versus I'm going to make an assumption about a group of people I've never interacted with. I imagine if you go to like Italy, for example, where they really respect the wheat and the pasta and the bread, I think that it's probably more likely that the farmers are producing it and that it goes relatively quickly to the market or the bakery or the whatever, and it's getting processed and eaten much quicker. I think that that's probably a part of this too. I wish I had a good statistic, but I think I read somewhere that grains could sit around in a silo or in a pile for, I think it's an average of 1 to 2 years before it's consumed here in the United States.
Yeah.
Which is just a little ick.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a little ick.
Yeah,
but I'm trying to think, where should we go from here? So we talked about, go ahead.
Well, I've got a couple little ditties I can share. So just to share a couple references to give some background. So still piggybacking on the food allergy conversation that we had initially, and this idea of the timing of when you introduce the food playing a role here. There was one study that I found called Food Allergen Introduction Patterns in the First Year of Life, a U.S. nationwide survey. And this was just December of 2022, so it's relatively recent. And they did find, they said, more than half of the caregivers are not More than half of caregivers are not introducing peanut by age one, and one-third are not introducing egg, though an observed shift towards earlier peanut and egg introduction has been seen in the past 5 years. Peanut and egg introduction seem to co-occur and are associated with increased intake of other food allergens. So basically what that says to me is that half of people are still waiting to introduce peanuts until after 1 year, which is that's the old recommendation, right? Is to wait. And right. Similarly, about a third of people are waiting until after 1 year to introduce eggs. And again, we are starting to see now that delaying introduction is actually increasing the likelihood of food allergy. So still, this December of 2022, this is very recent. Half of people are still not following the more current guidelines. So honestly, if this episode serves any purpose, maybe we're going to have somebody listen to this episode who's a new parent, and maybe they don't know about this, and maybe listening to this episode helps change their mind or give them the encouragement to start introducing allergenic foods earlier. I think I've seen stuff too, even saying that you should give your kid a little lick of peanut butter at like 5 months old.
Yeah.
Even before you're really introducing a lot of solid food.
It's funny. There's a study. It's called the EAT study, EAT. And it's an acronym for Inquiring About Tolerance study. It was by King's College. They looked at babies. They had babies introduce allergens between 4 and 6 months. So like pretty early. And then they had a control group that continued to breastfeed and didn't introduce things till later. Or breastfeed, or it looks like, I don't think they included formula fed babies, if I'm looking at this right. But they had people who introduced between 4 and 6 months, the babies, there was no incidence of celiac disease. Whereas the babies that were in the control group, there were 7 babies. So it was a higher incidence of celiac disease in that group. I think there was a total of 1,300-ish babies in the study, and they broke them in half.
A pretty decent-sized cohort.
Yeah. So, this is kind of showing maybe fairly early introduction would be helpful. I don't even know if we introduced that early, but yeah, that's fairly early in terms of And I do think it's interesting because probably people that listen to this and who have gut issues might struggle with gluten or might struggle with dairy or egg or something. And those to me are the people that might be like, oh no, like if I have an issue, to me, it makes sense to be a little concerned that maybe your baby might have an issue too. But again, like that might not necessarily be the case.
That's a really good point. And it brings up this potential idea that if you as the parent have a lot of food fear or health anxiety or health OCD-ish kind of stuff, or if you've, if you've done a lot of diets and you're always on some new diet, like, oh, meat is evil, now grains are evil, now fat is evil, now fat is good, now meat is the only thing I could eat. That's the sort of stuff that might lead you to believe that you need to delay introductions. And even I will admit too, Jess is almost 8 years old. And so I was aware of the idea of earlier introduction being better by the time she was born. But just knowing my, having celiac disease and the risk there, I do think that we didn't introduce wheat until she was 9 or 10 months old. Cause I remember it still, we were at a restaurant with my in-laws when they were in town. And I remember saying like, oh, give her a piece of bread. And everybody was like, what? Are you kidding?
Right.
Like, no, like she needs to get introduced to it. And I would rather do it here than at home and have gluten crumbs all over the place.
Right, right.
Even knowing what I knew, I still kind of delayed the gluten intro a little bit more than maybe I should have. Maybe we should have tried to give her a piece of bread at like 6 months instead of 9 or 10 months. But it is what it is.
Yeah, I think again, like there's so much going on when you're when you're a parent. So just do the best you can. But maybe earlier is better with some of these allergens is essentially what most of the research is saying. I think, you know, what's kind of fascinating too, just historically when I've worked with clients that were kids, so like you're primarily working with their parent, I would say it was very rare to not have the parent have some issues too, where they've already worked on like their SIBO or something, or their IBS, or they're working on some of their gut symptoms. And again, sometimes too, like the kid doesn't seem that bothered. Maybe they have some gut issues, but it's not really like bothering them that much. But the degree of like intensity that the parent's focusing on the kid, which I get, because if you had gut issues and it really affected your life, you're just trying to, in some way, protect the kid. But I think it can get a little out of control sometimes. When I've worked in those types of relationships, I don't really work with kids a whole lot anymore, especially younger kids, for a variety of different reasons. But I do think one potential reason is like, I don't know, there's a lot, you're not necessarily just dealing with a kid who doesn't have tons of control over certain things, but you're also dealing with like the parent's potential biases, which sometimes you can coach around, but there is a tricky element, I think you're right, with parents that might have a disordered relationship with food or their own fears that could affect the outcome for the kids introing foods or trying different things food wise.
Yeah. Well, and I'll share this. I mean, this is a really extreme example of it, but I have an old friend, this was years ago, but I have an old friend that when she had her baby and they were introducing foods, she's had a lot of health issues over the years, including a hellacious case of SIBO and candida. And she was so freaked out about introducing foods, even like even talking to me, and I reassured her that it was going to be fine. It was going to be fine. Like neither you or your husband have any history of allergies or anything remotely allergenic in your history. And the kid has never shown any signs of allergies whatsoever.
Right.
Even with all of that, she was so freaked out. I kid you not. She loaded up her kid in the car, drove to the parking lot of the emergency room and introduced these foods in the parking lot of the ER. And then they would sit there in the car and stare at him for like half an hour or 15 minutes. I don't even know. But they would just stare at him and sit there in the car until they were convinced that he was okay. And then they would drive home. And, you know, on the one hand, part of me wants to applaud that. Like, that's kind of brilliant, right? If you're freaked out and you really think that this is going to be a bad thing and this is going to happen, absolutely be, you know, two steps out of the front door of the ER and you could rush the kid right in. Part of me thinks it's brilliant. And then part of me now is like, holy crap, that's a lot of health OCD, health anxiety kind of stuff that you need to tackle. But yeah, I think that the parents' relationship with food and the parents' relationship with their health and their body and their comfort level with risk and their assessment of risk is potentially going to influence this quite a lot.
Right.
But yeah, that was probably the most overt case of that.
Well, and it's, you know, what's so interesting about that too, is like, usually if kids are going to have a reaction to food, it's going to be like the second or third time. So like, I doubt she was going back to the emergency room for the second or third.
Interesting.
You know, so typically, again, if you have a kid try a food, it's usually going to be the second or third introduction where they're going to have a reaction, not the first one. I think it's because the immune system kind of sees it, makes a decision of like, oh, it's cool, or nope, we don't like this. And so it makes the decision after the first go. So when you do it a second or third time, that's when you really get more of a reaction. So that's why, like, for when we did CC stuff, usually I would do like a week of a food where I would have her intro like wheat or something. And then a few days later, I would intro it again. And then a few days later, I'd intro it again. And then like after the third time, it's like, oh, she's good. And then again, the next week I might try another allergen.
Yeah.
That way you're kind of somewhat controlling the variables.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So that's what I did. It was pretty laid back. It wasn't super intense.
We were very willy-nilly about our food introduction to a point where it's laughable, because I was super convinced that this would not be an issue and we had nothing to worry about. So honestly, we didn't even really have a strategy, and we let Jess lick stuff off of our spoons a lot when we were eating dinner or something, or we would just let her nibble on stuff if she seemed interested in it. But I think the only one that we did super intentionally was probably peanut butter. Mm-hmm. And then, like I said, a little bit later on, I remember being at that restaurant and telling them, go ahead and give her a piece of bread. She needs to have some gluten. Other than that, I think we were not super intentional with any of the others. It was just like, oh, I'm eating some eggs, I'm going to give her a nibble of the egg.
Right. Right.
I think also it's worth mentioning, I hypothesize that there are some indicators that might tip you off that your kid, I don't want to say that your kid is at higher risk of having that sort of a reaction and having an allergy, but I think there's no better way to put it. You know, because you're kind of trying to assess. Like, I assessed that my kid was not at all at risk and this was not going to be an issue for us, and therefore I took this really willy-nilly laid-back approach. My friend, for whatever reason, assessed that her kid was super high risk for some reason, and or just any degree of risk she was uncomfortable with, I guess. And so she did this kind of over-the-top version of the intro. I've met a lot of babies, or I've met a lot of parents and their babies, where the baby had some reactivity to food through breast milk. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I couldn't eat dairy for X amount of time when I was breastfeeding my baby because they would break out in a rash or they would have an issue. Or like, I couldn't eat eggs when I was breastfeeding. I couldn't eat this when I was breastfeeding because my baby would have an issue with it. That, to me, might tip you off that that could potentially be an issue down the road. Now, the thing is, I've never fully wrapped my head around this, and I don't know if we know the answer. It could be that the allergen is getting through into the breast milk and then triggering an immune response, right? So like the egg protein or the casein or whatever. Also, cytokines can pass through breast milk. Mm. And cytokines are these immune messaging molecules, and they're the messaging molecules of inflammation. So what I'm trying to say is, if mom is super inflamed, or if mom is super like histaminic and super allergic to the world, or if mom is dealing with a lot of toxicity or burden, there's a likelihood that that inflammatory signaling is going to pass into the breast milk. And then you happen to couple that with some food allergens getting through to the breast milk. So I've seen this play out both ways. I've seen the babies who seem to react to like dairy, for example, in breast milk. And then sure enough, they have a dairy allergy when they try to introduce that as a food. I've seen it go the other way though, where they have an issue with a food when they're breastfeeding, but then once they wean, the food allergy goes away. And it's more the mom's breast milk. And I hypothesize the inflammatory state of the mom's breast milk that's playing a bigger role, in that it's just the baby's immune system is reacting to a food when otherwise it might not do that. That's a whole can of worms though, because then we get into, should you as an individual breastfeed? Like, is it a net gain or a net is it a net anti-inflammatory or a net inflammatory thing for your baby to breastfeed them? That's a whole other thing for another day, and I don't know the answer to that. But I think that that kind of stuff might tip you off. Also, remember from the histamine episodes where we talked about certain conditions kind of clumping together, right? So in the histaminic, allergic sort of world, we've got asthma, eczema, hives, migraines, you know, all of this allergic and quasi-allergic stuff. So similarly, I bet that babies who struggle with eczema and a lot of itchy, rashy stuff probably would be at slightly increased risk of food allergies, if I had to guess. I haven't seen data to support that, but just knowing the immunology of it, I would bet that that would be the case.
Yeah, it's funny. My Armand had horrendous eczema, in his early years. And you kind of wonder, like, was he reacting to something in the formula? But him and his sister both had horrible eczema. So I was kind of keeping an eye on that Cece, but Cece never really had anything close to eczema at all. The only, again, thing she has gotten a little bit of is, like, a little bit of baby acne when she first came out as, like, my hormones were shifting. And she has, again, like, the isolated hive that I think is more due to, like, skin reactivity of, like, her clothes sort of rubbing in a weird way than anything internal. I don't know how to describe it, but no, yeah, I think
that makes sense.
I think the eczema situation is really interesting. And it's always heartbreaking too, because eczema is like so miserable. And like when a little nugget has eczema and is like scratching and,
health issues suck when you have them, but they suck 10 times more when it's your dog or like your pet or your kid.
Right.
Especially when they're young, because you can't communicate with them. Like now, if Jess gets sick or if she gets constipated or she gets a bump or a bruise, I can talk to her and we can, you know, we can talk about, it's going to be okay. Here, take this. This is going to help you. Here's what you can expect. But when it's a baby or an animal, you can't communicate that to them. And I think, I just wonder if every moment of the sickness, they just think, oh my God, I'm dying. This is the end.
Right. No wonder they're screaming in the middle of the night wanting you to hold them all night, you know?
I know. And then the cruel universe we live in has baby teeth cutting through soft gums.
I know.
Why aren't babies born with teeth? That just seems so mean. Why do we make them slice through their poor little gums? And then we make them do it all over again when they drop the baby teeth and they get their adult teeth.
Yeah.
What weird universe do we live in?
Yeah, I'm like in a weird day though. Go ahead.
Sorry, my rant was apparently not over. Then, once you get adult teeth, that's all you get. You only get the one pair. If we're going to do this weird, like, cutting teeth thing, can't we be like sharks and just have a never-ending supply of new teeth coming in? Because then you get to be an older person, and you start wondering, oh, God, I didn't floss for, like, any of my 20s, and now I'm just totally screwing myself over, and I'm going to have dentures and implants and root canals and weird stuff. It's. I feel like we're getting shafted on both ends.
Yeah.
Either we're bored with our teeth and we don't have to cut teeth ever, and that's just how it is. Or we're like sharks and we get a never-ending free supply of new teeth whenever we want them. But we're stuck in the middle. Rant over. You continue.
Well, I would be more pro that, except Cece's been biting me lately while breastfeeding, so I'm pro. I'm more cool with them not having teeth, but I don't know, the biting while breastfeeding. And it's funny because I keep looking up like what to do, and they're basically like, you just say like no biting and then you don't feed them, like you just take your boob away. And I'm like, well, that seems bad too, because like, are they just not gonna eat? I don't know, like I think I've been doing that to a point. Like, I kind of say no biting, and then I take a break for, like, 10 or 15 minutes. And then I very, like, begrudgingly, like, offer the boob again, hoping to God she doesn't bite me. And then again, like, you're wondering, like, does she sense my tension? Like, I'm sure she does. So it's funny. Breastfeeding is, I'm about at the end of my rope with the breastfeeding at this point. So,
hey, you're doing better than my mom in a way. My mom still to this day swears up and down, I bit her one time and her milk dried up immediately.
Oh my God.
And she was like, I tried to pump. I was drinking water like a crazy person.
Oh my God.
I was trying and my body was just like, nope, we're done. So yeah, apparently I bit her one time and that was just game over for her. And that was it.
It's hilarious.
Gravy train pulled out of the station, never to be seen again for little baby Nikki.
I've had, again, like, because too, she only breastfeeds from one boob, like, the weaning process, I think, is just going to be a little rough for me, because at least if you have two boobs to kind of, like, carry the milk supply, but when you have, like, that one boob, the one workhorse boob that's just, like, we gotta keep up supply, like, the whole time is just working its tush off, and the other one's just the lazy sack flopping in the wind, like... like, I don't know how else to describe it when you have one boob that's just hyper, is working on overdrive. It doesn't, it like doesn't know how to shift gears into whenever again, like my, I, we've, there's been a few times again, like we've supplemented a little bit of formula here or there because we don't really have a supply. And, again, whenever I give her, it's been hard to even wean, like if she had one bottle a day of formula, because my boob gets so big, and then like my boob doesn't get the message that like it needs to chill. So
yeah,
again, the weaning with one boob to me, I think seems, it's much harder than doing it with two, I'd imagine. I don't know. Maybe I would have the same issue with two, but
maybe, I don't know. Maybe a survey our listeners. Did you breastfeed your kids? And if so, did you have one boob or two that were doing their job? I mean, you can't be the only one who has one workhorse boob and a slacker boob. So that can't be an anomaly.
Well, I think from what I've heard talking to other moms who breastfeed, there's always like one slacker boob and one like high-powered boob.
It's usually like an ounce or two difference, though. It's not
right,
all versus right. Zero.
Well, and again, to be fair, the left one wasn't a slacker in production. Cece just didn't like that boob. So basically, I think what happened over like a couple month period was that she would like hop on that boob and have like a little tiny bit and be like, ah, screw this, and would fight. And then I would go to the other boob and drink a whole bunch. So essentially, like my boobs were like, well, she's not really liking this. So then supply kind of dropped.
We're not going to make milk in this boob if we don't have to.
Right. So then the supply in the left boob went down a bit. And then when I would try to feed her then, because there wasn't as much supply, like the letdown wasn't as intense. So she hated that even more. So then it kind of gradually went down in production. And even if I tried to pump, I was only getting like an ounce. Like I'd pump like 15 minutes and get an ounce. And I was just like, screw this. I'm going to let it dry up. So
yeah.
Left, that makes sense. good old lefty. She's been dry for probably 4-5 months, maybe. I think I stopped. Go ahead.
I was gonna say, when we do the chunking up for like the time cards on the YouTube version of this, we'll have to label this one boob time.
Okay. Right. I know.
I mean, it is tangentially related. It is tangentially related, right? I do think, if I remember correctly, granted this has been like 8-9 years since I really looked at this research, but if I remember correctly, I do believe that breastfeeding is associated with a decreased risk of food allergies for obvious reasons, because it's good for the microbiome. So I mean, you know, our little 5-minute foyer into boob talk territory was actually semi-related. Well, but also I will say breastfeeding is freaking hard. So if you've beat yourself up thinking, oh my God, I'm screwing over my kid because I didn't breastfeed. Oh my God, I'm a terrible mom. I mean, I just want to give you a hug if you're thinking that right now.
Right.
Because it is such a freaking struggle. I know very few women who felt like breastfeeding was just super easy and came naturally and there was no issues.
Right.
So.
Right.
You know, I think, it's one of several factors that will influence the trajectory of your child's immune system, but also don't beat yourself up over it if breastfeeding just wasn't in the cards for you.
I love that. Love that message for sure.
C-section also. That's another one. Vaginal births are associated with decreased risk of allergies, and C-section births increase risk of allergies. But again, I will say, birth is hard. I was this close to a C-section. I'm sure I shared this when you came back from maternity leave, but can you indulge me for like 2 minutes to share my little story again?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Please.
UNC Chapel Hill is brilliant, Brilliant. Because what they did, I thought was very unique and very smart. I had been in labor for so long and I'd been pushing for like 5 hours. And finally they were like, okay, we need to get this kid out. So I think what they did was they went down to the street below and they picked out like the first tween or like middle schooler that they could find. And they were like, hey kid, come here. We'll give you a lollipop if you put on these scrubs and go pretend to be a doctor. So they send this middle schooler up, I think, put her in scrubs and have her say with a straight face, I'm the surgeon. Here's the informed consent for your C-section. I kid you not, Amy, this kid looked like a kid. She looked so young. And I was 29 at the time, and I knew like I was pretty young looking to be in a medical field, but my God. And I just, it scared the bejesus out of me so much that I rallied everything I had in my spirit and my soul, and I pushed that kid out vaginally. But it was by the hair on my chinny chin chin. It was so close. We were in the operating room. Said middle schooler was standing there like, I don't know this because I was too focused on pushing, but I imagine, you know, we were in the OR. Mike had a gown and a mask and the whole kit and caboodle, and everybody else was all gowned up and masked up. I'm just picturing that 12-year-old surgeon standing at the side of the room like,
oh my God,
like, you know, like with a scalpel in each hand or something, like, yeah, right. Bring it on. I don't know if she was doing that, but that's how I imagine it now. But yeah, we were ready for the C-section. Everybody was in place for the C-section, and it was literally like, all right, for the heck of it, let's give it one more push just to see what happens. And by God, I got that kid out vaginally. So I also do not judge anyone for getting a C-section anymore, because birth is freaking hard. And obstetrics is one of the most ass-backwards fields of medicine, as far as I can tell. There's a lot of weird stuff in obstetrics that make it more difficult than it needs to be, probably. And it's not as evidence-based as I would like it to be. But yeah, you know, and I was a C-section baby and I don't have any allergies. So,
I think that's again, like, it's funny because like C-sections terrified me. I think I talked about this in the OCD episode. Like, that was one thing that I obsessed about, like what factors I could do to reduce C-section, which you could probably go about doing some of those in a way that wasn't obsessive like I did. Like, I think you can do maybe like the last 8 weeks, like ball exercises for like 10 minutes a day or something, where you're kind of opening up the pelvis and, you know, talk to your doctors about ways that you could reduce it, or like make sure you're kind of on the same page of using that as a...
Also, just select a doctor or select a clinic or a hospital that doesn't have a super high C-section rate.
Right.
That's a really big thing too. You can call the clinic or the hospital or the doctor's office and ask them what is their rate of C-sections. And I forget what the national average is. I think the national average is like 30%.
I think it's like one third. You're right. It's about like one third.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you call a hospital or an office and ask for their rate of C-sections and they say 80%, run. Run the other way.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. So I actually asked, I think my hospital that I gave birth at was like 38% or something. It was a little above average. And but then the doctor explained to me, like, they are the most high-risk hospital. So you could ask for, like, nuance, because, again, everyone high-risk is going to this particular hospital, so it could ratchet up. But, again, like, she was just trying to say, like, I'm at lower risk, personally, for a C-section, because I had a lower-risk pregnancy. But, again, like, there is a time and place for a C-section. Like, it cracks me up. My sister...
Absolutely.
I swear, like, my sister probably wouldn't have survived having birth, because her baby's head was like 90. And again, it's funny because you look at a lot of like the natural birth, people are like, there's never a situation where the head's too big. But I'm like, I swear to God, this kid's head was too big, because it was like 97th percentile for head and his body was like 20th percentile. Like, this kid's head was huge. It was like a normal size baby with a huge head. And literally, he wasn't going anywhere. Katie pushed. My sister was at the pushing stage. Didn't drop. He was basically stuck. His whole head was a cone head. Like, again. So, again, who knows? She could have died, you know, in the past, because there weren't...
Women used to die in childbirth all the time.
Right.
That was a fairly common thing.
Right. That's why, again, like, to some degree, the doctors are going to be maybe overly cautious about protecting the baby and making sure, like, nothing happens to the mom. Now, again, like, it could mean that you have a C-section, which, again, is, like, more intense, and I don't think anyone really wants a C-section. But if I've also seen
that in death, though.
Right.
Sign my ass up.
But I also kind of had to remind myself, too, like, I've also had friends that have had horrific vaginal deliveries where they've had major, major issues postpartum, recovering from, like, a horrible tear or something vaginally. So, again, like, either way, there's an injury to the tissue.
Not to make this... This is quickly turning into an episode that would terrify new mothers versus right. Initially we were like, oh, maybe somebody will hear this episode and re-strategize their intro and maybe this will, you know, help right. some people. This is quickly turning in a different direction, but Mike's aunt, now granted, she gave birth to her son in like 1990 or 91, but she fractured her pelvis giving God. Birth. What?
Oh my God.
What? That's insane. You know, this is the sort of stuff where, again, I like to think I'm not a judgmental person, and I truly try not to be, but becoming a parent has made me even less judgmental than I already was, because I will admit, going through like functional medicine classes and going through chiropractic school, you get fed this dogmatic BS all the time. And you hear this stuff about, well, vaginal birth is better for food allergies and better immune system and lower risk of this and that. And you do kind of get brainwashed into thinking, well, why wouldn't you do a vaginal birth? Why wouldn't you breastfeed right? until the kid is right. 32? Why would you not do this? Are you just a shitty parent? And then you become a parent and you realize this is hard.
Right,
right. This is really hard. And yes, there are some people who choose to do a C-section and like a scheduled C-section, or they choose not to breastfeed just for like vanity reasons or selfish reasons. But there's also people who just can't do a vaginal birth, or they can't breastfeed, or they try right. and it is terrible for them. So I don't know. I think we need to judge each other less. One of the things
yeah,
of this
for
episode.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, again, I think, I know we've talked about it, but I like hypothesize that some of my like postpartum OCD anxiety is heavily related to breastfeeding. So there's been sort of like a debate on how to proceed breastfeeding wise. Like, do I continue doing it? Do I continue not? So there's been discussions around that too. Like, I think if someone's having a lot of mental health struggles too, I would not never judge them for stopping breastfeeding either. And again, just in general, it's hard. I've had some people who, I was talking to one of Armand's friends who it was taking her daughter an hour to breastfeed in the middle of the night. So she was basically like breastfeeding every for an hour and then sleeping for an hour and then breastfeeding for an hour. And so, like, again, it was just insane. Like, she was getting no sleep. And it's like, there's situations
like that. I wonder
if that
kid has a tongue tie. Like, that's super inefficient. It shouldn't
right.
take that long. That
potentially, maybe she had, but she, I think the main problem was the baby kept falling asleep. Like, she was kind of a lazy breastfeeder, so the baby would fall asleep. She'd have to kind of wake the baby up, make sure that like, the baby kept
slap the baby's cheek. Right. Like, come on,
hurry up. So that she was saying, like, it was just really rough because, like, she wasn't a super fast eater, and then would kind of fall asleep, and then she'd have to kind of wake her up, and then she would keep feeding, and it was just this whole process. And she was even like, her and the baby's dad like broke up. Like, I just can't imagine being like a single mom, you know, having this kid that's breastfeeding horribly. Like, what do you do? Like, I don't think I would have continued breastfeeding.
That's
she did
you,
it first.
You stop breastfeeding. That's what you do.
Right, right. Exactly. But she continued breastfeeding for a while, even like with those parameters going on. And I'm just like, I don't think I could have done that if I was kind of on my own.
Yeah. Oh, I wouldn't. Oh my God. Right. Anyway, let's, I think we've made our points, certainly. But yeah, you know, breastfeed if you can, but also we know it's hard. And again, it's just one of many factors that are going to influence your kid's immune system.
Well, and I think, you know, we've touched on it a little bit, but, you know, I wonder too how much the microbiome shifting probably throughout time, like all the overuse of antibiotics that started really in like the late 80s, I would say, where there's a lot more antibiotic use. I just wonder a little bit about that too. Like how many courses of antibiotics is typical for a kid before the age of 5? I would think it has to be way more.
That would be so interesting to study, but I wonder how we would get that data. To look back, like our parents' generation growing up in the 50s and 60s, you know, how many antibiotics did they have versus, I can tell you for me, truckloads, absolutely truckloads. Because even if you think about it, my first ear surgery, the first set of tubes I got put in, I was 2 years old, which means the ear infections were already that bad of a chronic issue that they were already going to the tube stage of things, which probably meant that between the ages of birth and 2, I probably had many rounds of antibiotics for ear infections. And that, again, like by the point they got to the tubes, that was kind of like the Hail Mary of sorts, or like, oh, we need a more aggressive solution. So I guarantee without a shadow of a doubt in my mind that I had truckloads of antibiotics when I was a baby, but I haven't really heard my mom talk about getting a lot of antibiotics when she was a kid.
Yeah, I don't think they really gave them out. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I know it became way more prevalent. But yeah, I honestly just think they would grin and bear things a lot more in like the 60s, 70s, where it's like, oh, you have chicken pox, whatever, like go over to your friend's house, give them chicken pox, get it over with. Like, I feel like there was that kind of mindset a little bit more.
I think that's part of it. I think also, again, the world is changing and they, you know, our parents' generation and older, they didn't have the same chemical exposure. They weren't, you know, they weren't altering crops as much. I think to some extent or another, had a healthier diet. There weren't quite as many like ultra processed Frankenfoods at that time. I do think, you know, by the time you got into the 50s and 60s, convenience foods and TV dinners were becoming more popularized. But hearing stories growing up, you know, my grandmother was a stay-at-home mom and she was cooking home-cooked meals for most of the meals. So yeah, I think that the nutrition was different. The world was different. Stress, I think, was different. I don't want to say that previous generations had less stress than us, although part of me wants to say that because look at all the crap that we millennials have lived through. But, you know, it's at the very least, it was a different world, that it was a different ball of stressors that they experienced. So again, I think
it's weird because I feel like
some
past generations, I think, have a lot of trauma, but like weren't having chronic stress day to day. Like I think their jobs might have been a little bit less stressful. I think like less screens, like some of just the modern world is way more stressful to deal with. But, you know, I couldn't imagine like fighting in World War II or something like that and the stress of that, back in those decades. So, you know, it is interesting. Like, I feel like they have really big, sometimes big T traumas like that, like a war, like an outright crazy war that, you know, I can't imagine living through. I know my grandfather was in World War II and like his brother died in World War II. My dad's writing a whole book about it. I don't know if I've talked about this, but he's releasing out into the world soon. But, you know, my grandpa like didn't talk about it, but it's like, I just couldn't imagine like friends dying right and left, your brother dying, and then like going back and
and not knowing if you'd be back ever.
Right. So I think there was definitely like some big T traumas, but from a world standpoint, like you're saying, like toxin exposure, probably day to day, like less screen time, slower. It seemed like nothing was like so quick. Like even the internet, like information is so quick. Like everything just took a little bit longer. Everything was just slower. So I could totally see that. Yeah, but I think that
our bodies are dealing with a lot more than they ever have in human history. And again, I'm not going to say better or worse necessarily, because if you think of caveman times, right? If we think of the paleo diet argument, right? Of, oh, our Paleolithic ancestors didn't eat grains. Well, your Paleolithic ancestors also dropped dead at the age of 30 from weird infections because they didn't have any medical care. Like one cut was enough to kill you back then. So I don't know if I aspire to go back to the Paleolithic era necessarily. I do think taking the best of both worlds from, you know, the modern world and modern medicine, including drugs and surgery, taking the best of that world and the best of the olden days and like less processed food is really the answer. I don't know if one is intrinsically superior,
right?
But I think we could definitely say the world is much different than it's ever been. And with that comes a lot more challenges, and our poor immune systems and our poor bodies are just trying to adapt.
Right. Yeah, I think, it's nuts. But I think you're right. It's probably some combination of processed foods, less fiber. I think that comes into play with the processed foods. Like, you're getting less fiber, antibiotics that are going to wreak havoc on the microbiome, more sedentary lifestyle that, you know, would provoke, that seems to promote less diversity and affects the microbiome in different ways.
More prescriptions in general, not just antibiotics, more, you know, antidepressants and PPIs and painkillers and opioids and name it.
Right. I agree. And again, I think you're right. Just the level of toxins and like detoxification that our body is stressed by on a daily basis. And again, could be affecting the microbiome in different ways.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that, again, it is a culmination of a bunch of stuff. I don't think it's like, oh, you're a C-section baby, you're screwed, you know, or anything like that at all.
I hope not, because I'm a C-section baby.
Right, exactly. So again, and there's certainly babies that are breastfed and vaginal delivery that have all sorts of allergies. So it's there's a lot of different factors to these issues.
Well, there's maybe even a little bit to be said for genetics too.
Right.
I wouldn't have developed celiac disease had I not had some celiac genes on my mom's side of the family. Right. And that, you know, it is what it is. 40% of Caucasian people have at least one celiac gene. So the odds are with you that there's about a 50-50 crapshoot that you're going to have one of those celiac genes.
Right.
But there is also that. And I think I mentioned this in some of the histamine issues. I have one good example. An acquaintance of mine, she and her husband have 4 children. Every person in that family, the mom, the dad, and all 4 kids, every single person has at least 2 of the following diagnoses: history of asthma, eczema, hives, mastocytosis, mast cell activation syndrome, anaphylactic food allergies. Every single person has a minimum of 2.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was talking to her, I remember talking about this, that, you know, here's her husband who, for whatever reason, was already pretty allergically poised. Right. I forget which one goes with each person, but like, here's the husband with a history of with asthma and eczema and seasonal allergies. And then he happens to marry this woman who also has a history of asthma and eczema and like migraines and all of this histaminic stuff. So these 2 histaminic allergy prone individuals get together and mate, and they make 4 allergically prone babies.
Right.
And then, you know, any little thing, you know, not breastfeeding or a C-section or mold exposure or toxic exposure, any little thing is just going to nudge them off the edge. You know what's funny, though?
Right.
Of their 4 children, and this will be a mind-you-know-what for you, rhymes with duck. of their four children, their oldest child was not breastfed, and she's the one with the least incidence of allergenic issues.
Dang. Yeah.
Like, all three of the breastfed kids have more allergy issues and like mastocytosis and mast cell activation disorder and hives right. and eczema and weird shit. The one who wasn't breastfed is the healthiest out of the whole bunch. I think she has maybe mild eczema and that's it.
Right. Right. It's crazy.
So, you know, oh my gosh, it's so complicated, but I wanted to share another thing with you. I think that, so I touched on this lightly, the idea of looking back at the Paleolithic, you know, ancestors versus modern humans. And my God, the world is so different, right? But even in the span of 50 years or so, the world is different enough. We are different enough. Our chemical exposures are different enough that we're seeing a drastic increase in some of these conditions. So I remember I was able to pull up this study that I remember Datis Karazian bringing up years ago. The PubMed ID, if anybody wants to look it up, is 1936253. It's a 2009 study titled Increased Prevalence and Mortality in Undiagnosed Celiac Disease. And what they did, they looked at 9,133 healthy young adults at Warren Air Force Base. And the blood samples were collected between 1948 and 1954. Then they looked at 12,768 gender-matched subjects from two different cohorts, and they compared the data. And I believe the data for the second cohort was taken in the early 2000s. I don't remember the exact year now, and it doesn't say here in the abstract. But they said during 45 years of follow-up, undiagnosed celiac disease was associated with a nearly fourfold increased risk of death. The prevalence of undiagnosed celiac disease seems to have increased dramatically in the United States in the past 50 years. And when they looked at the two cohorts for the more recent, 12,700 people, the incidence of undiagnosed celiac disease was either fourfold higher or 4.5-fold higher. Mm. So big, big honking difference in a matter of 45 years. That's huge. So if you feel like we do, you know, like I grew up the first 18 years of my life and I never met a single celiac. And then I met my first celiac friend in 2004. And then now, oh my God, even outside of my work, I have met so many celiacs. And even I'm trying to account for the fact that I tend to go to gluten-free meetups and do that sort of stuff.
Right.
But even just casually hanging out with moms and doing play dates and going to school functions or chit-chatting with people at conferences that are not medical related, even that, I feel like I meet celiacs all the time.
Yeah.
Let alone for my professional life. So again, I went from meeting one single celiac in the first 25 years of my life to celiacs popping out of every corner, every nook and cranny of the world, practically.
Right.
And I don't think that that's just my perception. I think that it genuinely is really on the rise, much more than we perhaps realize.
Yeah. No, I 100% agree. It's interesting. And again, I like that the study, like, it's not being convoluted, because again, a lot of times people will say, well, we are just more aware of it now. Like, I think that that's like a big argument with like the autism space. And maybe it's more, again, I don't know much about that. But
well, it's
again,
both for that too.
Right, exactly. So a lot of
there
times
there's data on that.
Right. So again, I don't know much about the autism argument, but it seems like a lot of people are like, oh, it's just a it's just a being diagnosed more. And it's like, is it? I don't know. Like, maybe there's a little bit of that, but does that explain such the big jump? I don't know. Like, that seems extreme, you know?
It appears to be both, just as a side note.
Right.
That's what I would think. Robert Melillo has a book you can get on Amazon, and I think it's titled just Autism. But he talks about the things that have been associated with autism. So like vitamin D deficiency in the mom during pregnancy increases mm-hmm. the risk of autism in the child. And I think if the mom gets severely sick, like a bad flu, for example, if the mom gets severely sick, I think it's in the third trimester, that mm-hmm. is actually associated with an increased risk of autism in the baby. So there are things that have been studied, and he talks about that, but he also goes into this idea of, are we just more aware of it? Are we overdiagnosing it now, or is it really on the rise? And he makes a pretty solid argument and goes through the research and shows, no, it's both. There is definitely an increase of awareness, and there probably are some people getting diagnosed on the spectrum who don't maybe genuinely belong there. That's a controversial thing to say. But it's also that it is genuinely on the rise.
Right. Like, I think in the past, maybe someone would just be like, oh, they're like a little different, but wouldn't necessarily be labeled autistic back in like the 60s or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And to go back to the study, they were
that
looking
study,
at...
They were looking at blood. That's what I'm saying.
Well, yeah,
so it's like a true...
Undiagnosed celiacs.
Right. So like they were looking at
true... So you can't say it was an awareness thing.
Right. That's what I'm saying. I like that research because you can't... It rules out that factor where it's like it's objective data that they're looking at, not just like clinical diagnosis... That could be much more subjective.
Yeah. So again, if you feel the same way that we do, that food allergies and celiac disease are on the rise, you are not wrong. They definitely are. Some things are within our control. So again, like the age that we introduce foods at, that one is definitely in our control. You know, breastfeeding and C-sections to some degree is within our control, to some degree it's not. Even honestly, just getting your kid outside and letting them get dirty, the hygiene hypothesis, right? Are we keeping our kids inside with hand sanitizer and a tablet, or are we letting them go get filthy outside and drag in a bunch of germs? Are they around pets and animals and just being filthy little mud balls like they're supposed to be? I honestly think that that's why I'm as healthy as I am. Looking back at the volume of antibiotics I had in my lifetime, and, you know, the surgeries, and I was a C-section baby, I, on paper, look like somebody who should have had issues much earlier in life, and I should have had a lot more allergic issues, but I grew up on a farm, and I was constantly filthy. You know, we were playing cornfield tag, and I was out in the barn, sitting on the barn floor, trying to tame the feral cats, and I was out in the field, petting the filthy horses and shedding them out and braiding their manes and stuff. And I was playing with the dogs who regularly brought back dead possums and dead raccoons and skunks and stuff and left the dead animal for us to find. And then
that was your
the
prize.
Dead animal that would be in their mouth, the dead animal in their mouth. And then they use that mouth to like lick us. Ugh. Some of it's a little gross to think about, but I was getting bathed in so many microbes all of my childhood. And I really think that that's a big reason why I'm so healthy. I think that if I had had my life, but just grew up in a city, or if I grew up with parents who were super crazy about hand sanitizer,
right,
I probably would have a lot more issues.
Yeah, for sure. Oh man. Well, Cece's been freaking out. I don't know if you've heard her. She's like, all right, she's freaking out. So I might need to hightail it out. Armand seems overwhelmed.
That's all right.
I can't see him. I can just sense it.
You can. The spidey sense is going. Well,
I know.
That's okay,
the spidey sense is like, oh God.
We reached a natural conclusion, and Cece knew that. She has her spidey sense kicking in, and she knew that her mom was done, and she's demanding you come back to see her because she's the big cheese. I am not, unfortunately. But, you know the drill. Subscribe, like, leave us a 5-star review if you think we earned it. Please and thank you. You could follow us on Instagram. Amy is at Amy_HollandCamp_RD. I'm at gut.microbiome.queen on Instagram. Come find us, and we will see you right back here for the next episode of the IBS Freedom Podcast. Thanks for tuning in.